Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is Paul Hollywood, an artisan baker. He's brought a lifetime of skill and knowledge about bread, cakes, pies and pastries out of the kitchen and onto our TV screens. As a judge in the hugely popular Great British Bake Off, when he dishes up the criticism, the oven gloves are most definitely off. With a flash of those famous blue eyes and a dig at their soggy bottoms, he makes grown men and women crumble on national TV. So what separates him from so many of the hammed-up telly tough guys that populate reality shows these days? Well, he's for real. At 14, he was in his dad's back shop putting the jam in the doughnuts. By his early 20s, he was head baker at the Dorchester. His award-winning first book, 100 Great Breads, has been translated into 7 languages. To watch him deftly twist and coil a savoury brioche couronne is to watch a man clearly at one with his craft. He says, you know where you stand with me. I've always been like that, not just on Bake Off, but with the lads that work with me in the bakery, because, well, that's what my dad was like with me. So welcome, Paul Hollywood. It makes good TV, of course, all that shooting from the lip. But I wonder why, you know, on TV, it's a make-believe world. Why do you feel you have to be honest?
I think you have to be. I mean, last year's Bake Off, funny enough, I found it very difficult to judge because the standard was just so high. It threw me for about 2 weeks. And everyone's saying, Paul's being easy on him this year. And so what I did was move my bar up, and then people started falling into the traps again. If they do something wrong, I'm not going to turn around and say it's good, because that would be a lie.
Well, you don't have to say it's good, but you could say, look, I know you've put your heart and soul into this, but you maybe... You know, Mary does that, doesn't she? Kind of softens the blow a little.
Yeah, Mary does soften the blow a little. And so did the girls, so did Mel and Sue. We're looking for the best amateurs in the country. And that is almost borderline professional. Therefore, I have to judge them with that bar. Mary will judge them from a home baking point of view, but I can't do that because I don't know home baking. I only know professional baking.
Listeners, he's doing the eye thing. You know the eye thing? You get those very serious eyes when you talk about
that. They close up, do they?
It's easy to make light of baking, isn't it? You know, the truth is, though, that there is a sort of deep resonance, particularly with things that are baked, that come out the oven. They are sort of inextricably linked to memory and home and places. Why is that?
It's because it's very nostalgic baking. Where I was brought up, we used to have Sally Lunn's. Now, a Sally Lunn near me was like a massive ice bun with fruit inside it. It wasn't my dad's bakery, funny enough. It was just the local bakery down the road. And I used to walk down from school, pick it up, and come home from school in the afternoon and carve up this huge ice bun with butter and then eat it. And it takes me back to when I was a kid. There's so many people I've spoken to who have their favourite bakes when they were kids, whether their nan made it or whether their mother made it. My mum's ginger biscuits have become famous. And Tom Kerridge tried some recently and he said, they're the best ginger biscuits I've ever had. I said, they are, aren't they?
Does your mum still cook them for you?
Yeah. If I'm coming up, I'm saying, Mum, maybe some ginger biscuits, please. They're more cookie-like, actually. They've got lots of butter in there, so they bend.
So a cookie has a bend and a biscuit has a snap.
Yeah, you know that.
I learn. Yeah, we'll come on to your critique of my banoffee pie a little bit later, don't you worry. Tell me about your first track this morning, Paul Hollywood. What are we going to hear?
This is a Lenny Kravitz track, which takes me back actually many, many years. It's called Strut, and I used it as my entrance music on my tour last year.
Could you do these live baking tours?
Yeah.
Very popular.
And this music always pepped me up, and it's such a funky track. Oh, I love him. I think he's a great guy. Baby, do you know who I think you are? You are a dream. You are a star. So let it out and bring it on the scene and show the world exactly what you mean. Baby, stop. Let me see you walk. Stop. Let your body talk. Stop. Show me how.
That was Lenny Kravitz and Strutt. We dared to put a rather shabby-looking Pano Raisin in front of you this morning, and you've been sort of picking it apart there. What's wrong with it?
It's underbaked and it's quite raw inside.
I didn't bake it, I should say.
It's OK.
It's really not OK, though, is it? It's difficult to overstate the success of Bake Off. It's watched by 10 million viewers. The final of the last series was watched by no fewer than 15.6 million viewers. I mean, these are the figures that people who make television programmes only dream of these days. Yeah. What do you put the success down to?
I think it's very easy watching. I've watched a couple of them last year. We normally have all the whole family around. We all watch the first one together and we have a few drinks and watch the programme. The music, the tent, the weather, Mel and Sue, Mary Berry, the bakes. It's one of those things that at the end of the programme you think, isn't life lovely? And I think that's part of it. And actually, when we do a bake, they sell out the next day in the shops. If it's a particularly good signature bake, people go, I'm going to go and buy that. People can actually bake these at home very simply. I don't think it's one answer.
And I've always heard you be nothing but not just polite, but incredibly affectionate and enthusiastic about Mary Berry. What do you not like about her? What are the things about Mary that annoy you?
She can eat as much as she wants and doesn't put weight on.
Can she?
Yeah.
Well, that's irritating.
Isn't it?
Have you ever been on a no-carb diet?
That's the work of the devil.
I'm glad we agree on something.
That's not right.
I've seen Mary sitting astride a motorbike of yours. I don't know what it was, if it was a Harley or whatever, but it was just
Ducati.
Right. Yeah. Did you take her out for a ride on that?
No, I wanted to, but that particular bike doesn't have any pillion pegs, so she couldn't. I could have stuck her on a tank, I suppose, and taken her down the road.
Can't damage Mary Berry.
No. She really is game. I drive her everywhere. You know, normally when we leave the tent and go to the hotel, you know, she always has a Chardonnay, a cold Chardonnay. So we sit outside. I'll normally have either a Hendrix or a G&T and just sit outside and we just put the world to rights. Then we have dinner together. And then about 9:30, we normally disappear up. You know, she goes to her room. She says, you're okay. Do you need any ironing doing? I said, no, I'm fine, Mary.
So Mary Berry is ironing your shirts?
Mary Berry has ironed a few of my shirts on the first series. Not so much now because we've got wardrobe. Oh. We've gone up market now. We've actually got an iron. But she is like my mother. She acts like my mother. I do treat her like my mum. And she's met my mum. And they get on really well. They were gossiping in the corner for hours, you know. But no, I've got a real soft spot. You know, I really do genuinely love Mary. She's great.
Let's have your second piece of music, Paul. What are we going to hear?
This is something that takes me back to when I was probably 5, 6, 7 years old. There was a guy next door, the Reese family, when we were living in Wallasey, and he had an MGB GT, and it was a Sunday, and it was quite a nice day, if I remember rightly. And he lent it to my dad, and we went out for a drive in this car, and it was an MGB GT with a little shelf almost at the back. And we used to, you know, slide in back and forward on the shelf, thinking we were the kings of the world. And my dad's favourite song at the time, and my mum's, was The Most Beautiful Girl in the World by Charlie Rich. And it just takes me right back to those days. And I think it's a great song.
Hey, did you happen to see the most beautiful girl in the world? And if you did, was she crying? If you happen to see the most beautiful girl that walked out on me, tell her I'm sorry.
That was Charlie Rich and The Most Beautiful Girl in the World, and memories for you, Paul, of sliding around in the back of that little sports car when you were just a little thing. You were born, as you say, in Wallasey in the Wirral.
Yeah.
Born in 1966. Tell me a bit about Jill and John, your parents.
My mum was always the certainly looked after me and my brothers. My mum and dad divorced when I was 10.
And you were the eldest of three?
I'm the eldest of the three, yeah. And we lived in it was a really nice house, I remember, till I was 10 years old. Then we moved down the road. Then there was just my mum and my brothers. But I think my early days certainly were fantastic.
How would you and your brother spend time out of school? What did you get up to?
We were part of a church in Wallasey, so on Sundays after church, we'd all go off together, you know, big family groups and play football everywhere, you know, and it was all very family orientated. And everyone used to play in this road, going out on bicycles. skateboarding down the road. We seem to spend all our time outside. And I'm very acutely aware of, you know, my boy growing up, that he had time outside, not just stuck in the house.
And what about you say, you know, it was a really nice house we lived in, there was lots of stuff on the weekends as a family together, and then at 10 your parents divorced.
I mean, it hit me quite hard. I mean, I remember I'd stand on top of the, I'd sit on top of the shed roof and just refuse to go to school. It took me a while to get over that. But then I think when I went to my last comprehensive school in Wallasey, things started to calm down a bit for me then. My brothers were great, and I think, you know, being part of the church as well when I was growing up was strong. That was a good backbone for me as well.
And you say it affected you. What happened? Did you have a bad temper?
I think I sulk a lot. I would be angry, but it's not something that really manifests itself into anything. But I just tend to sulk a lot and go quiet, you know. I was actually quite a quiet kid. I suppose when my last school, I was a bit of a sweat.
What's that?
Long hair. Into Zeppelin and Floyd and all these other music. So, yeah, I was leathers and Wranglers and stinking of petunia oil. But that was quite the norm for our group.
Let's have some more music, Paul. Tell me what's next.
My uncle was a canon now. And I remember going to watch him in church, and he sang this, My Sweet Lord, George Harrison, with his wife, Jenny, my auntie. I mean,
what a cool
vicar at the time. And he had long hair. He looked great. But also the fact that George Harrison being a Liverpool lad, and this is one of those songs that really takes you back to the 70s, and to my uncle singing this song in church, classic.
My sweet Lord, my Lord, my Lord, I really want to see you.
My sweet Lord, George Harrison. They say, Paul Hollywood, that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. Your father owned, was it 20-odd bakeries he had at one point?
I think it was about 15, 20 bakeries, yeah.
Do you remember the first time you visited one?
Yeah. It was in Derby, Spondon. And I must have been probably 10.
What did you make of it?
Amazing. I mean, amazing. The smell of the bakery and donuts. I think donuts were frying at the time. And when you're a kid, a donut with jam in it. And I remember you pierce these spikes.
I know, I've done it.
And you inject. But I just went, boom, boom, boom. And it was just swelling up, you know. I was expecting this thing to just go bang and everyone's going to be covered in jam. But I think later when I joined my dad's business, he had a head office in York. And I used to spend time with him and my brothers. We'd jump across on the train and then we'd go and spend time with my dad over the weekend in the bakery as well. And so I would try and help out in the bakery, trying to earn a bit of pocket money. My brothers would be doing something in the bakery. And I remember my head was sort of like this at the table, looking over my eyeballs, watching these bakers handcrafting everything and making the pies and the cakes. Fascinated.
Your mum, I read, was a graphic artist. And I've always noticed when you're judging, particularly the batch bakes on Bake Off, that everything's got to be the same size and everything's got to be glazed the same and everything's got to be very neat and tidy. Do you think did you inherit some of that precision? Because she was a pottery painter.
She was, yeah. There is certainly an element of that from my mum. Never thought about that before, but yeah, there certainly could be. Certainly from my dad, I always look at it how it would look in a shop, how it would look as a group amongst others. And would I actually buy one? So there are the certain criteria that goes on inside my head. But it served me well because it helps me judge.
Is it true, Paul Hollywood, that it was in fact an act of bribery that got you into to baking professionally in the beginning?
It was.
What happened?
I was in art school and I had long hair and velvet jackets. And I quite enjoyed art, you know, sculpture and all that stuff. And I ended up doing an O-level in sculpture. And I thought I could really take this further. And my dad approached me and said, son, come and join the industry. And I went, he said, I'll give you 500 quid. And that was, you know, in the 80s, that was a lot of money. So I went from hair down to sort of my chest length to shaved, literally overnight, just vroom, I had a flat top. And he paid me 500 quid and I got my car licence, August of 1983. And that was almost about a month later I started working for my dad.
And life, I imagine, I mean, It's really hard work, isn't it, for a young boy in his 20s?
I was exhausted. I mean...
What time do you have to get up at?
Well, I'd be in the week, probably about 1 o'clock. And on a Friday night, then we'd be in about 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. I'm working through till about 11 the next morning, you know. The hours I was doing were ridiculous, and I was only quite a slight kid. I mean, you do start bulking out a lot when you're baking. It's a very manual, physical job. The flour bags, I could barely lift them. I was exhausted.
More in a second. For now, some more music, though. Tell me about this. You're fourth.
This is comfortably non-Pink Floyd. I mean, this goes back to the 80s. I did have tickets to watch The Wall in concert, and I couldn't make it. I was working. This song takes me back to loving all the rock music, Pink Floyd especially. And this track is just one of the best songs I've ever heard.
Pink Floyd and Comfortably Numb. So there you are, Paul Hollywood. You've got the buzz cuts. You've passed your driving licence. Your dad's bribed you with 500 quid to work in the bakery. Watching you in the masterclasses that you do on television and in your own TV series, you know, I mean, when I introduced you today, I said it's a man at one with his craft. How quickly did that come to you as a young boy? Did you automatically sort of find you had a skill for it?
Yeah, I did. At the time, I didn't know because my dad would never say I was good, ever say I was good. I only heard it 6 months ago. It took him a long time. I think he just thought he'd said it when actually he never did. He'd watched Pies and Puds. He'd watched something I did. Oh, it was very good, that son. Yeah, he'd done well. And I went, sorry, Dad? What did you just say? That threw me.
Did you have a bit of a moment?
I think I did. Inwardly, I certainly did. I think giving praise out, my dad was just not that type, you know. But that made me the person I am. That gave me the ambition, the drive. I have a huge amount of drive inside me and ambition to be the best, to do the best. And even in baking, I still learn every day something different. I'm not the best baker in the world. I enjoy doing what I do, and I try and almost evangelise that through television to get people to bake. But I'm not, I just love what I do.
What were the circumstances of you leaving the family business then? Because you went on down to London to work at the Dorchester and Clifton. And
I think I was 1920 and we had a bit of a bust up over, I think, a girlfriend at the time. And I lost it, you know. I was a bit homesick, if I'm honest. I was living in Lincoln at the time. And my mum and all my mates were back in Wallasey in the Wirral. And I was seeing a girl at the time from Liverpool. So I think I used that as an excuse and said, I can't work for you anymore.
You were in your early 20s when you ended up as head baker at the Dorchester. Now, that sounds, It sounds rather good on the CV, but the truth is, you know, bakers in a big kitchen like that who are filling the bread baskets and making the croissant, the pain au chocolat, they are pretty low down the pecking order. How were you treated in the kitchen?
I mean, actually, not bad. I think I was about 24 or something. I left my dad and went to work for a couple of businesses locally in Liverpool. Ended up working at the Chester Grosvenor. And then I remember saying to my mum at the time, I've seen this job. I don't want to go for it, but I have to go for it because I'm career-led. And it was a massive challenge. And I got the job. I was the youngest head baker that I'd ever had. And I was a bit excited, nervous as well. But if you were head of a department, you had one of these really nice places in Queensgate Terrace. So I had a little white balcony. I had 2 days off every couple of weeks. And on my day off, I'd be lying in bed, and I click, click, clop, click, clop, you know, from the horse guards coming down every morning. At 5 in the morning, when I only lie in, and I get woken up by the horse guards coming past it every morning. But I loved it.
How long did you stick it for?
I think I stuck it for, in the end, about 8-9 months. I had a bit of a bust-up with the chef in the Dorch. And then I got a bit itchy feet, to be honest, to go back home. And I just said, do you know what? Thank you very much, South. I'm back up north, and I just disappeared back up north.
Let's have some more music, Paul. Tell me about this. We're on your fifth.
Well, this is Innocence by Enigma, and this is my time in London. I think it's Barker's on the top in Kensington, going up there clubbing on my days off with the guys from the hotel, meeting all the other chefs from the Savoy and everywhere, and really feeling, for the first time, away from home. Feeling, emotion.
Memories of your London clubbing days, Paul Hollywood. That was Enigma and Innocence. You worked then, as we know, you called it the Dorch. I'm going to call it the Dorch from now on. The Dorchester Hotel in London's Park Lane. Also at lots of a few other posh hotels. And then you decided that you were going to venture much further afield. You went to Jordan and Egypt and Cyprus. Do you think it really informed your sort of more artisanal approach?
Yeah. I was in Jordan. I went to Petra. And when you go past the Treasury, which everyone remembers from Indiana Jones films, and I went into one of the caves, and all the strata of the rock, you could see orange and greys and blacks, and there was a Bedouin woman sitting in there with a flame. And above that flame, she had this piece of dough in her hand. She was just throwing it around, and it looked incredible. And I said to the rep, can you tell her that I'm a baker and I'd like to? And she looked at me, she smiled, no teeth. And she said, sit. So I sat down with her and I was playing with this dough, and she nodded. And we baked it and she gave it to me. I tried it. It was some of the most beautiful bread I've ever had in my life. And it's something which stuck with me. And I thought, I need to replicate this. There's so much more to a flowery bloomer. I need to get involved with sourdoughs and understand what these people are doing. And that's when I started really playing in the hotel and experimenting with different flavours.
When you started your television work, you dabbled a little bit in Cyprus. Did it seem like something you could then go and make a proper living and a career? Because, as you say, you're a very ambitious man.
I didn't know. I mean, at the time, Thane Prince was filming a programme called Food from the Village. And my wife, Alex, was PR for the hotel at the time. And she mentioned to them and said, oh, you should meet my husband. He's the head baker here. And he said, oh, is he Cypriot? He said, no, he's a Scouse. And they went, we'd love to meet him. So I met the producer and did this filming with him. And Thane said, you're quite natural on television. I went, oh, thank you. You know, I was shaking like a leaf. I didn't know what to do. And then they said, oh, you should do some more when you get back to England.
And you said you were quite a shy youngster. Did the shyness, the nerves sort of disappear?
No idea where it came from. I was told, whenever you're talking to the camera, forget about the cameras. When you talk to someone, think of your three best mates sitting on a sofa. So whenever I crack a joke or talk to Mary or whatever, the people watching don't exist. It's just three of my mates sitting on a sofa. I talk to them when I'm talking to the camera. I'm talking to them. And that's how I dealt with it. You know, it's not something it's normal for me to do. I shouldn't be doing this. But I've just fallen into it, you know.
Well, it was 2009 then, if we gallop a little bit ahead, when you were asked to get involved in this show called The Great British Bake Off. First of all, what did you think of the format? What did you think of the name? What did you think of the idea?
I was approached just before Christmas, it was. And to be honest, things were tricky for me at the time. I'd forgot about TV. I was just working in my own bakery, doing my own books, doing everything all on my own.
And you had your own artisan bakery
van.
Business?
I had a 10-year-old van, and I used to deliver everything. I used to do all the invoicing, I'd do all the baking, I'd do everything. I actually really enjoyed that. And then out of the blue, I got a call from a company called Love Productions to say, we'd be interested in talking to you about being a judge on the Great British Bake Off. And I went, what? Well, what's that then? And I thought, okay, so this young person arrived at the station, all of a 16, 17, with a little camera, and I went, right. Because I thought they'd bring a crew. And they literally tipped out a load of baked stuff. There was muffins, there was cakes, there was rolls. And they said, can you judge them? And the camera went on. And I went through and judged everything the way I normally do. And he went, that's great. Thank you very much indeed. They said I'd be working with an older person. That's all I was told. And then I walked into an office in London and Mary was sitting there. She goes, oh, I knew it was you. And I just thought, oh, it's great. It's like working with the Queen. And I go out and give her a hug. And it was just one of those things which we just hit it off straight away.
Can I tell you, your impersonation of her is rubbish.
You don't know her.
She sounds nothing like that. Let's have some more music, Paul Hollywood. What's next? We're on your sixth disc of the morning.
This next track is by George Michael, and it's Jesus to a Child, and it was played at my wife, Alex, and I's wedding in Cyprus in 1998. And it just reminds me of that day. It was fantastic.
Kindness in your eyes.
That was George Michael and Jesus to a Child. So, Paul Hollywood, we've discussed the extraordinary success of Great British Bake Off. There came a point when you were chosen as a judge for the American version of the show. How did that go?
Oh, fascinating. I was told to do the same job, and that's exactly what it did. I'd never been to the States before in my life, so looking at the recipes, I was thinking, really? The amount of sugar in that? So I was more acutely aware of, I'm going to teach them, you know, they can't put so much sugar in everything. They need to use natural sugars. Honey is perfect to go in there. The technical challenges were mine. It was the same, but it wasn't the same, if you know what I mean. It didn't feel comfortable initially. It took a long time to feel like I'm back in the tent again.
It wasn't recommissioned. What was it that went wrong?
I think it came down to the editing. So it'd be literally 1, 2, 3, change shot, 1, 2, 3, change shot, whereas that's not Bake Off. Bake Off is those long, lingering shots where you're looking at a cake or a bread or a pie. I didn't get it. I really didn't get it. I was doing exactly the same job as I do on this one.
One of the downsides of fame that you'll be more than well aware of is that, yeah, you get all the perks, but also when the bad news comes, it gets covered, as it did with you in the tabloids. There was a lot of speculation that you'd had a brief affair. When you look back on what I'm sure was a turbulent and difficult time, what do you think you learned?
I mean, personal life is personal life. You know, as far as I was concerned, I didn't think anyone was interested in me. You know, I was just happened to be attached to a big programme. I didn't realise how big it was until, you know, the press got the teeth in. And anyone that could sit there and say, oh, no, I'd deal with that, that's dead easy. It's not, because it plays with your head, it plays with everything. I was upset. I mean, I was really upset. I was more worried about the family more than anything else. So for me, I think it was accepting the fact that I was famous. That took years to get used to. I love the anonymity. I ride motorbikes now with a helmet on, so no one knows who I am. I love anonymity.
It is almost impossible to put fame back in the box. And I'm wondering, I would guess that inevitably your professional life is populated by, you know, publicists and agents and schedulers and book deals and so on. Do you ever long for the simplicity of the night shift and the dough and the oven?
Without a shadow of a doubt.
Yes.
When all this is done, I will end up probably having a little pizzeria, a little bakery in the village. I'll be like those French bakeries where you don't know when I'm going to open, and I'll just wander across the road, fire up the oven and make some magic in the oven. And actually, that simplicity, I mean, I like nothing more than going home, having a bath, whichever time I actually get in the door, whether it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon or 8 o'clock at night, sit down with the family, watch a good movie, and then go to bed. And I have my dressing gown on by 7 o'clock most evenings and my feet up on the sofa. That is where I am. That's Paul Hollywood. That's the real guy.
Let's have your next choice. Tell me about this piece of music.
This song is by Coldplay, and it's Fix You. And I'm very close to my brothers, Lee and Jason. And Lee got tickets for me to go and watch Coldplay in Bolton. And we were bopping around all night. And then we had a few drinks afterwards. It was just a fantastic night with me and my brother having a good bonding session.
Could it be worse? Lights will guide you.
Fix You, Coldplay. Paul, I've heard that your wife, Alex, is a very good cook.
She's indeed. She always was. That's how we met, really.
What's your favourite?
I love her tartiflette. Tartiflette and steak is just stunning. Her baking is actually really not bad. I mean,
Careful.
Well, this is the beauty. She's a cook, I'm a baker.
Yeah.
And this is why it works.
And are you competitive?
No. She's very messy in the kitchen, I'm not. But she creates magic, like a true artist.
What would be your desert island dish?
Pork pie. Yeah, pork pie with an egg in it as well. When you bite through a crispy hot water crust pastry, which has been layered in loads of egg to get that lovely shine, and you crack through that, and then you hit that little bit of gelatin, the jelly on the top, Then you hit the pork and the onion or bacon, whatever's in there. Then you go through the quail's egg. I know everyone's salivating at the moment, thinking, I'm going to go and get a pork pie. And then you eat the whole thing together with tomato, cucumber. Sorry, that's just the best food in the world. Food of the gods.
I imagine you're a very practical person. You like big machines, mechanical things. You know, you ride motorbikes, you have fast cars, very good with your hands. I imagine on this island you could probably lash up a shelter, you could fish, you could take care of yourself.
I reckon I probably could. I'm a dive master.
Right.
So actually I'd probably spend most of my time under the water. I could probably find out where the octopus are, and I reckon I'd be all right. I'd like the peace and quiet. I'd certainly like the peace and quiet. That would suit me down to the ground.
Do you ever bake with your son?
Yeah, the last thing we did was pizza, and we made a chocolate cake as well. I did his birthday cake, and I did something I hate. I actually bought chocolate fingers around the outside, only because he wanted that, and I couldn't say, son, sorry, I'm going to have to make them myself. I said, do you know what, I will, but we do like baking.
Tell me about your final choice then, Paul.
Now, this is my son all over. He loves DJing. We had a party recently, and he loved doing all the mixing of the songs. And this track just reminds me of him when we're all on holiday together. And he introduced me to this, and I thought, what a cool song. And it's six words, Wretch 32.
Let me count my blessings. One life, two children, free time, four dreaming, five senses, six words. I found my treasure in you. Found my treasure in you. Bronze, silver, gold, no, it's you.
That was Wretch 32 in six words. So, Paul, it's time for me to give you some gifts. You get to take the books, first of all, the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare,
okay,
and a book of your own to accompany them. What's it going to be?
I would say it's a book by Geoffrey Wellham, and it's called First Light. And he was one of the youngest pilots during World War II in the Battle of Britain Day. I think he was 17 when he first flew a Spitfire. And it's just a story of bravery, you know. I mean, I remember what I was like at 17. To be put in charge of a plane like that and losing friends daily. I mean, what these guys went through, and it's such a great book. I've read it a couple of times.
OK, that's yours then. You're allowed a luxury?
I would say a pillow. I always have one pillow which I sort of lean on and another one underneath my arm. They've got to be just right.
I'll give you two then.
Yeah, I'd need two, okay. Definitely.
All right, two pillows. And if you could only keep one of these eight tracks, which one would it be?
I think the most chilled out song, which represents all our life and I still listen to a lot now, Comfortably Numb, Pink Floyd.
It's yours, Paul Hollywood. Thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.